Hey guys, welcome to the Cinepile Podcast, the podcast that discusses films that matter. And this is episode 20 and a half. And just so as a reminder, 20 and a half will come by, and every half episode will come by after we have one full episode at the beginning of the month, a half episode, and then one more full episode. So just to keep up with the content schedule and just kind of remind everyone what we're doing, that's what we're doing. But aside from those topics, we at Cinepile are kind of dispersed right now. Neil is way down under. He's in Australia. Cue didgeridoo music. And Kyle is in Poland right now with his brother. And I'm in Dallas, Texas. So I didn't want to do another solo podcast because it was just too lonely. So I am here with my other roommate, Gibson. Gibson, say hello to the kind people.
Howdy, y'all.
So Gibson will be joining us for episode 20 and a half, where we review and discuss what I thought was a pretty solid movie, The Hunt for Red October.
The most brilliant commander in the Soviet Navy.
Ramey has trained most of their officer corps. He's nearly a legend in the submarine community.
The most deadly submarine ever built.
This thing could park a couple of hundred warheads off Washington. Nobody'd know a thing about it until it was all over.
Once more, we play our dangerous game.
With our old adversaries,
the American Navy.
His plan is a mystery.
A man with your responsibilities reading about the end of the world.
Apparently, he has suffered a kind of nervous breakdown in which he announced his intention to fire his missiles on the United States.
We want us to help you hunt him down, kill him.
Open the outer doors, firing point procedures.
We sail into history.
I'm going to blow him right to Mars.
Ramius might be trying to defect.
You're just an analyst. What can you possibly know what goes on in his mind?
I'll give you 3 days to prove your theory correct.
I am not field personnel. I am only an analyst.
You're perfect.
I'm expendable.
He's defecting.
You willing to bet your life on that?
From the best-selling novel by Tom Clancy. From the director of Die Hard.
Give this man a chance.
My orders are specific.
Battle stations.
Sean Connery, Alec Baldwin, James Earl Jones, Scott Glenn, Sam Neill. The Hunt for Red October.
Now, kind of coming at it, I honestly didn't really expect... There are some things that you have to overcome with this movie. And I think the hardest part is the Scottish-Russian.
Yeah.
But once you suspend that disbelief, pretty fun movie.
Yeah.
It's directed by John McIntyre. Who you don't really know the name, probably. We didn't know the name, honestly, but once I looked up the IMDb profile, I realized that secretly I'm in love with John.
Right.
Because he made what? Last Action Hero?
Predator.
Die Hard?
Die Hard with a Vengeance.
And sadly, Rollerball. But hey, you know, you can't shoot them all. He also did the Thomas Crown Affair.
13th Warrior.
13th Warrior and Basic, which honestly, like, these are all solid. If there is a standard 90s pack for action hero films, John made them.
Yeah,
Mr. McIntyre made them.
Did it well.
Yeah. And so for a short synopsis, I guess, for The Hunt for Red October, essentially it is about Sean Connery as a Russian admiral who is driving this experimental sub that the Russians have made. The first time that the Russians are ahead of the Americans with technology. And essentially is just kind of running his own thing. What would you say? He's just kind of running, he's running his own ship.
So basically, oh yeah, spoilers.
Spoilers ahead, folks.
Basically, he gets command of a Typhoon class submarine that has a caterpillar drive. So basically a silent drive. And basically he realizes what this is for. This is just for destruction. And he decides to defect. Throughout the whole movie, you don't know, though, or a lot of the characters the party's in, mm-hmm. don't know what he's doing. They don't know if he's gone rogue and is just going to launch all of his missiles.
Just a madman.
And Yeah, and so basically everybody's after him. The Russian, whole entire Atlantic Russian fleet is, and then the Americans are.
Yeah, and then the other surprising part is, so you have, you know, Sean Connery as, you know, one of the more pivotal characters, and then surprisingly Alec Baldwin.
Oh, yes.
Oh, so good. Cue that from Team America.
Don't forget James Earl Jones.
Oh, yeah, and James Earl Jones with that radio voice. It was actually really nice to hear James Earl Jones just talking with his, like, powerful, like, magnanimous voice. I was just like, my God. Like, can you imagine just, like, him ordering some waffles at, like, IHOP? He's like, I'd like to have you. He's like, oh, my. Yes, sir.
Whatever
yes,
you
sir.
Want. Yes.
But I remember it was really funny because it being 2017, I'm so used to that super, super clean, polished image. And this movie was a little rough. Like,
oh, yeah.
The film grain, I mean, I ordered that HD, you know, rental from Amazon. And link down below if you want to rent it. And it wasn't really the sharpest looking film in the world. But I think it was authentic, I guess you could say. Like, I mean, that's not to try to excuse itself for looking so dirty in some regard. I felt like it had a very of the earth kind of look to it compared to, you know, other modern naval battle kind of films. Like, I mean, Last Battleship. I mean, obviously that's going to look really commercial. And, you know, a variety of other just kind of more like modern like Hacksaw Ridge or something like that. It's just almost the focus is too crisp, or like the shots are just too well lit and too clean. And this movie really gets dirty. It gets cramped. They use like these phenomenal wide lenses. I mean, when they shift focus between like the foreground and just like, you know, a character that's up close, the what's called the breadth of the lens in between it just like shifting is almost like it's like cinema candy to watch, because just seeing that like camera operate was really impressive, because it didn't really look that they had what's called like a wild wall set, so like that's sets where the walls can move for operators to have more room. It really seemed very, very cramped, and they carried that through really well. And I don't know, what did you think?
Well, yeah, that makes perfect sense, actually. Like, it's, you know, just kind of hitting me hard right now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because that entire movie, I feel I'm on a sub,
mm-hmm.
and and I'm thinking of the scene that focus in on when they do the transition from Russian to speaking English, so we don't have to subtitles anymore.
I thought that was pretty crafty. So what was it? The political advisor on the Typhoon class secret sub thing. He's sitting there talking, and he's reading some kind of excerpt from, I think it was Shakespeare, wasn't it? And I mean, it doesn't really matter. It's kind of moot. And I mean, I think it was from the Bible or something like that. It was some kind of powerful foreboding.
I wish I had the quote on me right now exactly. But the I am, you know, Vishnu.
Oh, it was I am death, like destroyer of worlds. The same thing that was read by
Oppenheimer.
What
he said after, you know, the nukes. Mm-hmm. It's just like, ooh. And so he's reading that out loud.
Okay.
That's the switch there.
Yeah, and how they do the switch is really cool. Like, you know, how they just kind of zoom in and slowly just kind of make him start speaking English, which I have to admit, like, that's a huge challenge. Because as a director, like, to see, you know, you're having corporate executive folk who are like, hey, Sean Connery's Scottish. he can sound Russian. Because, I mean, I thought when he was speaking Russian, he had some pretty good Russian, Ruski kind of sound to it, this coming from a person who doesn't know how to speak Russian. But, you know, I think they knew their audience really well, and how they did it is, I don't know how they could have done it, aside from just, okay, we're going to start talking in English now so the other Russian people don't understand what we're saying. That's Sean Connery impersonation.
I mean, it's a Tom Clancy book turned into a movie, and, you know, it was made in 1990, Cold War just ended, pretty much. So, you know, it's kind of a very America, heck yeah.
Yeah, it was like, I remember watching it I remember watching this movie a long, long, long time ago as a little kid. And I just remember them like talking about like 5 degrees down bubble, like left,
right, full rudder,
right, full rudder, Mach. And and just like all of that kind of action. And but getting into it, I think one of the better things that this movie did was handling the expanse between Alec Baldwin, you know, revolving around and working within the government to figure out what Sean Connery's character was doing, and then also going to the other plot of Sean Connery, to where neither one seemed to be like a meanwhile back at the ranch kind of thing. Both of them seemed wholly interdependent, but wholly full at the same time, which I thought was really well done.
Yeah, I mean, forgot to mention that Alec Baldwin in this is a CIA analyst that, when it starts off, he basically sees this caterpillar drive and is like, hey, I need to go fly to D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife, Dr. Crusher.
Oh, yeah. Dr. Crusher from Star Trek.
Yeah, so, you know, he's that operative. And he actually is a big submarine guy.
Mm-hmm.
And has actually done, you know, like, not expose, but like a biography or something.
Yeah, yeah, he did a
paper, at least.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it was a biography on, like,
I can't recall his name.
I can't recall his name either.
This is horrible.
But Sean Connery.
Sean Connery.
He essentially did an expose on him. So Alec Baldwin is considered to be, like, you know, the foremost expert in all things submarine. And kind of like in these kind of films, like, there always has to be that one guy who is getting the bits of information from everyone and going like, none of these people, if these people just communicated and just talked to each other, we could solve this. And he's that one guy who figures it out. And he has, like, this iron will of, like, not sleeping or anything like that. And it was kind of nice to see, like, Alec Baldwin in sort of not, like, kind of a joke or parody of himself. It was more so, like, we were at peak Baldwin.
Oh, yeah.
Peak Baldwin.
I like that term. That's a good term.
It should be on a T-shirt.
Yeah.
I haven't begun to peak Baldwin yet. But yeah, it really gets into it, and it's fun because there's mutiny within the submarine and everything like that, and there's fun little mysteries, and so like they actually have like really good subplots to it, and it's like really, I don't know, it's just the most like even keeled film that knows when to really turn up the heat and make you excited for it, and then it even knows like how to have like those silly 90 quips kind of thing, like where he's just like. Like Alec Baldwin, when he's like running through the reactor and the saboteur that he's chasing down, he has a gun, and like right before he goes off after him, what was it? He grabs him and he's just like, "There's a lot of things in here that don't react too well to bullets," and it's just, I was like, "You're Russian."
Oh yeah, and then he's up on the little rafters, mm-hmm. and then he quotes him, "Oh, things don't react well to bullets."
Yeah.
Just.
Meanwhile, like the other saboteur guy is just.
Shooting,
letting go of like magazines on a whole nother level, and yeah, I don't know if you
a fun, awesome movie.
It's, yeah,
simply put, it's like hell yeah, submarine battles, Russians, you know, the commies in America's duking it out pretty mm-hmm. much. You got that classic
battle.
You got the USS Dallas,
mm-hmm.
you know, stalking the Red October. It's just great. And then I forgot the other Russian sub that gets pulled in at the end.
Oh, yeah, from his pupil, his main pupil.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that came chasing after him. Yeah, and, like, I know, like, it was kind of funny because now that I'm starting to think about, because Gibb and I just recently learned that the fact that this director had recently done things like Predator and things like Die Hard. And, you know, a close-up of a guy with a sweaty face crawling on his belly to the conflict. All three of those films have that exact same thing. Like that character struggling between it, getting injured when Alec Baldwin has something fall on top of him, but he keeps going. John McClane getting his feet all cut up in that one particular scene. Arnold Schwarzenegger when he gets all beat up by the Predator, but still keeps on trucking. Yeah. And so like, It's interesting to see those kind of like motifs like continuing on in like that classic sort of action. I mean, it's just silly stuff like in terms of just like the like I don't know if you could call it necessarily a like art. I mean, I really could almost call it an art tour, but towards just like the steam pipes and the like particular kinds of like lighting and like the very dark style. Whereas like
yeah,
now you look at everything is so candy wrapper bright. in terms of modern cinematography. Everything's too afraid to go too dark now, right? I felt like in a lot of ways, like with Alec Baldwin, you would have one motivated light on his face and be like, you know, a red light or something like that when he's in the shit. And then you have something like, I don't know, something, I mean, I don't want to say Avengers or something like that, 'cause it's a different kind of level, but I mean, there are some modern, like, there's some modern like action films that I could certainly say are far too bright, are far too clean, are just, they're just,
I tend to not watch them. Like, yeah, so like your Cloud Atlas, or what's that other one? Jupiter Rising or something.
Okay, so I'll say I loved Cloud Atlas.
I've actually not seen any of these.
Oh, so you're just shitting on it for no reason?
Yeah, the only thing I know from Cloud Atlas is that Tom Hanks is in it, and what I know of that is from Rick and Morty.
No.
Yeah.
Well, we need to watch Cloud Atlas sometimes. Okay. And apparently the Wachowski siblings are about to release a director version, or they've been teasing a director's cut that is 4 hours long, because Cloud Atlas essentially covers like 400 or 500 years of time. And yeah, it's a really good movie.
Well,
Jupiter Ascending was one of the worst films I've probably seen in the past 5 years. Next to that other film that I just recently watched, that I was telling you about, that has that something Batista. What's his name?
Oh, Dave Batista.
Yeah, Dave Batista. He was. He was great in Blade Runner. I think it was just crappy directors. But I don't know. I don't want to talk about that too much.
Yeah.
But I think Hunt for Red October just kind of perfectly embodies like that. Almost, I mean, it was made in 1990, so it's like this burgeoning 1990s classic of leaving behind the 80s kind of crazy Rambo guns kind of level, which, I mean, granted, he does make Die Hard shortly after this.
But
Die Hard's a different kind of action film, and I felt like all the films are all different kind of action films, and they're not as mindless.
Last Action Hero,
also one of his films.
Great.
Can we just, let's just take a moment to just marinate in that. All right, that moment's over. Got a little weird even after a second. Yeah, I mean, even like Last Action Hero had, it was all these films are about kind of debasing the like machismo kind of like typical hero that can't get killed and doesn't run out of bullets. It's more so, yeah, Last Action Hero, you do run out of bullets. And it's about, you know, completely toppling the idea of an action hero, which is sort of what the 80s were. So it kind of makes sense that in a lot of ways that all of his films really adopt this new kind of action hero that we now see as like the flawed character in like the dark DC universe or in the dark universe of Marvel now. It was kind of it could have been, you know, very simple at the beginning of it, or like the beginning of a style that, you know, he and maybe some of our other directors were backing.
Yeah, just, I mean, my world's getting rocked. Because of, you know, that newly found fact of all the movies he directed, it's like, oh, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
In like pretty much every single one of those, the protagonist, you can be like, yeah, they go through all that.
And then I know, because you were talking about some other action films that you were wanting. So I don't want to just sit here and just talk about Hunt for Red October. You said that you wanted. You wanted to talk about something else.
Well, you haven't seen it yet, so you have homework to do.
Oh.
You told me you have not seen Star Trek First Contact.
I haven't.
And that is appalling, because that is the greatest Star Trek movie ever.
To be fair, I'm a pretty big Trekkie, even though I haven't seen...
That's not to be fair, that's sad.
Yeah, I guess. And I haven't seen Star Trek Discovery. We should watch that together.
We watched the first episode, though, remember?
I know, but I feel like it'll get better. You know what? Star Trek is like a marriage. You get through the thick and the thin, you stick by it.
See, I'm a next generation.
You push through the J.J. Abrams BS, and when you're talking to your kids, you're like, that's right. I pushed through that J.J. Abrams bullshit. And, you know, come out all the clear on the other side.
Yeah, well, you still need to see it. So we're not talking about
that. Okay, let me know. What happens a little bit in it? Give me a synopsis.
The Borg.
The Borg.
The Borg, basically.
Because like, that's where they turn Picard into, like, Locutus again, right?
No.
No.
No, that happens in the show. I actually have those episodes on Blu-ray.
So you have Star Trek First Contact here?
No. Those episodes where Picard gets turned into a Borg.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But, so basically, the Borg go back in time to about the time of First Contact when humans first... you know, discover warp drive and Vulcans are passing by at that time and mm-hmm. basically get pulled into the Federation. Well, on a last-ditch effort, so they, in their present time, the Borg basically get to Earth and are about to mess everything up. Picard comes in, saves the day, and then their last little-ditch effort, they create a time portal to go back in time to take over Earth.
Okay.
To basically... assimilated then.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah, so you know it kind of messes.
That's good. That's good. That's good enough synopsis. I'm like, we're about to get into spoiler territory for me here.
Okay. Truman Show is the next one.
Yeah, and I know you want to talk about Truman Show, and I remember Truman Show. That brought a couple tears to my eye when I watched that movie because that film deals with so much like existentialism. It wasn't until like I saw the film Anomalisa. I hadn't seen a film. It's a stop motion kind of film.
Gotcha.
You can watch it sometime. But yeah, like I remember, I miss Jim Carrey so much.
Yeah.
But he has a documentary called Jim and Andy that came out on Netflix. I wanted to check out. But Truman Show. So what did you like about it?
Just all of it. The story behind it, and then. You know, it's a cool concept because I remember seeing it when it first came out. I really didn't pay it any mind. It didn't hit me as hard. Then I, you know, saw it a number of years later again, which is like, wow. So, you know, the transformation of Truman, you know, he's finally realizing, hey, my life isn't what it really is.
Right.
And, just, you know, how his character develops and then, you know, kind of how he starts catching on and then, you know, dupes them in the end. And just it really that ending is one thing that always
where he touches the sky.
Yeah, so he, you know, he goes, they're looking for him and he, you know, fears the water, and they finally figure out, they look on the water finally, and he is just happy sailing. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And so they decide to bring a storm. He weathers that storm and then, you know, makes it out basically, and then gets to the edge, and just the peace that it brings, and just how he, you know, he climbs up the stairs at the door, and he just signs it off perfectly.
If I don't see you,
good afternoon, good evening, and good night. It's just like, fuck yeah, Truman.
Yeah,
you know, these people duped you hard, and you still gave them a flawless finale.
You kept it classy.
Yeah, you kept it.
Because what I liked about Truman Show is it's just like, I feel like with Truman, when he finally gets to touch the sky, it was sort of a symbolism kind of like on how humanity on a level realized that how much potential that we had once we kind of went to space. And it was just kind of man's, you know, trying to understand, like, you know, always looking up, trying to find meaning. And I always found the Truman Show was just like, because Truman is just trying to search for really who he is by, you know, finding something real to actually, you know, echo himself off of. Because, you know, if you think about it, if you have, let's say, a sound and you have a very echoey filled area, that sound would never be able to know what it actually sounds like. And in the Truman Show, he can never really have any kind of true level of understanding and identity because no one really acts as a proper sounding board for him to really echo back who he is. And I think that's why that one girl that he falls in love with and you know, ultimately, like, you know, is a driving force for him to find his freedom is such a central and pivotal character, because that character actually tells him that he's real, because to everyone else, he's just a product. And so, like, when he touches that sky, it's really like touching the realization that we all want. And that is feeling our true and whole, honest potential. And That's why that movie always brings a tear to my eye.
That's deep.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, maybe
I see it.
Maybe,
no, I see it.
And like, especially that one time where, what's his wife? Laura Lenny is his wife. And she holds up the cocoa and she's like, cocoa powder, because it's anything that you can do. And she's like becoming desperate and almost kind of manic. And he's like, what the hell are you, who are you talking to? And I think that's when, you know, it just starts to break and just starts to crack. And I think from adolescence to getting into your 30s, you can get into that kind of level of, okay, everything around me isn't necessarily the environment I need to be in. I need to kind of seek greener pastures. I need to seek something else. And I think anyone can resonate with that. And everyone does resonate with that because you see everyone who watches Truman, you know, the guy in the bathtub, the old lady, you know, all the people in the bar cheering for him, because it's not necessarily that Truman is them. And he's undertaking all of their emotional baggage in a way. And just like how you said, weathering that storm and pushing through and just getting through that hardship and everything else that everyone else deals with. But he comes out successful because he didn't ever turn back. Even though he got the opportunity to turn back, he said no, and he's kept on going. And I think that's why that film is so great, because the ending actually builds to something that is truly and wholly like resonant within an individual, resonant within the story, and resonant with all the other characters that he interacts with. And I think that's why that film is just a resounding like symphony of just like, excellent. And those are my thoughts on The Truman Show.
Yeah, you just kind of floored me right there, man. Just like, oh, wow, yeah. Just, yeah.
I watched The Truman Show like all... I went through a time when I was a little blue, and I watched The Truman Show like daily. And so I remember every single time, like, I'd be like, you know, it's like, okay. And I was like, you can push through. Because, I mean, everyone's got their sad movie. My sad movies are Silver Linings Playbook and The Truman Show.
I've never seen Silver Linings
Playbook. You never seen Silver... So you don't know what true love is?
I guess not. I thought it was a chick flick, so I'm not going to see it.
No, man. Come on. It's got Bradley Cooper in it. He's adorable.
My point, exactly.
We're going to watch it, and you're going to like it. Silver Linings Playbook.
I know. I need to see it. I know. I know it's a good movie.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say Kyle, Neil, and Cooper don't know what they're talking about in that movie.
Well, I'm not sure if Neil has seen Silver Linings Playbook, but Kyle has.
Sure, yes.
Kyle loves it. But I don't know, did you have any, kind of getting back to our original topic, the hunt for Red October, did you kind of have any closing, like, why should I see it? Sell me on it.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Sell you on it like I would sell me on it?
No, sell me on it. I'm just a stranger on the street. You said...
Fighting commies.
Fighting commies?
All right. Boom. Oh, no. Just, you know, you want a good classic submarine movie. You know, Tom Clancy book, some action, but on the silver screen.
Mm-hmm. Procedural.
Oh, yeah.
But not too boring, not too bombastically explosive like Transformers or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. You know, that's the right amount of action, the right amount of suspense,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, a little bit of mystery, and just, you know, good old American winning over communism.
Classic America winning over commies.
Yep.
So that was The Hunt for Red October, Star Trek First Contact, and The Truman Show. I think those are all pretty solid movies.
Oh, they are.
Yeah. Check out either one of those if you're listening right now. And also as a reminder, we're going to be wrapping up here, because these are a little bit of a shorter episodes, all of these half episodes. But don't worry, because next episode we're going to be covering something from the Criterion Collection. I know Kyle has something in store for me that we are going to be watching here shortly and going to be discussing. And Neil is going to be back January 11th.
Yes.
This Thursday. We've missed Neil a lot here at this house. But, so check out those films, guys. Let us know what you think. If you could, if you're listening to this on YouTube or iTunes, do what you can. If you can give us a like, please give us a like. If you can give us a review on iTunes, that helps us out a lot. We will read your review aloud, and if you have a movie at the end of that review, we will happily review that film and discuss it on the podcast. If you want to check out anything else, you can follow us on Instagram. It's primarily where we're most active, and that's at CinePilePod. It's CinePilePod. Pretty easy there. And if anything else, you can always reach out to us. We always have the information below on our episodes at the bottom. You can check it out. And all the information for all the movies are also below. And like always, guys, we really appreciate you, you know, taking your time out of your day to kind of listen to us just jabber on about some films that we think are significant in the wide pantheon of films. So again, thank you very much. We want to talk about films that matter. And like always, I've been Cooper Carr.
Gibson.
And I just want to say thank you very much, and we'll check you guys on the next one. See ya.